Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 161, AA, Buddhism, and Powerlessness.
Did you ever see that movie, Death Becomes Her, it's called, I think? About these people who couldn't die and then they wanted to? Because they were all twisted around by auto accidents and things. Remember that movie? Mm-mm. Goldie Hawn was in it. And all kind of people. So the point is, if you're here, we're all here. Like right now, here we are, middle of all of us together. We have the doc here, Dr. Who, Dr. Mark. And we have, he doesn't want to be Mark so much anymore. He likes to be Dr. Who. But you don't watch Doctor Who, I bet.
I don't know Doctor Who.
I know all these people. They don't watch TV.
You know
Doctor Who. I don't know if it's on Netflix, but it's so far out. Some of the Doctor Who, really it is. And now I lost track of what.
We're all here together at Menlo.
Oh yeah, so we feel we then it's Sunday, you know, lunch, and then pack up your. You know, unpack your pillowcase and put it on the floor, and then you go and you're back on Highway 28 and Thruway and the whole thing. And then, okay, great, good luck. But we're going to be back together forever, all of us. Every single one. One life or another. Somewhere or another. Next lifetime, you're going to be teaching the seminar. And we're going to be trying to figure it out. You know, you're going to be the doctor, and we're going to try to figure it out. So, will never stop. So therefore, what is the optimal way to relate to each other? Everybody's in love with everybody else. Not meaning that somehow they're going to molest and bother each other. It means that everybody is going to care about the happiness of everybody else. And in a way, there'll be your own concern will be sort of less important to you because there's so many other people you're concerned with. And actually, although that's the wonderful paradox, that's the wonderful cognitive dissonance, the more you want everyone else to be happy, the more naturally you'll be happy. The more you want yourself to be, this is Shantideva's unmatched, and the Dalai Lama has that lineage, unmatched teaching. And the more you want yourself to be happy, what happens? You're dissatisfied with how far you've gotten. So by thinking about, well, what's in it for me? How good is this for me? How good was it? As you're puffing away there on the edge of the bed. Not that good. Could have been better. Buy a different drug, do something. Then you want something else, get a different partner, whatever. It's not that good. So by focusing on your own happiness, you're just always dissatisfied. Forgetting about your own happiness because you so much want everybody else to be, then, hey, you're kind of like, whoops, I got cheered up because I didn't notice. Then I noticed, oh, no, what am I wasting my time? What happened? That Shantideva thing is really, it's just awesome, actually. And I think all the great, like, the great rabbis, like Jesus, he was just a great rabbi. All those people in Texas should have to figure that out one day. He was the rabbi. He wasn't even really quite right. There was a forensic guy in Western England, you know, who like helps find like murderers from skeletons, you know, and he builds up from the skull, you know, he builds up what they must have looked like. And Jesus looks like a Pakistani taxi driver. Mm. He does. The way he made it up, you know, Palestine that time, blah, blah, blah. So, olive skin, you know. So what's with this, like, silly thing that they have down in Texas. Well, I know the Baptist Republicans, and Jeff Sessions. They're not white anyway, they're blotchy pink. So that's the thing. No escape. Therefore, make it good. Make it great. Right? Doesn't that become so? That's the reason for emptiness. The emptiness is the solvent, the lubrication that sort of makes you able to face the idea of being stuck forever with everyone, and having to make it the best. You know, everyone wants everyone else to be happy. It's the opposite. The samsara is everybody wants something from everybody else and not getting enough. So therefore, everyone's dissatisfied, right? And afraid someone else is going to come and take their things, and that's like that. And if you think of embodiments, you know, the embodiment of a predator, the embodiment of all kind of crocodiles and things are like all armored, you know, the boundary, that armoring, the scales, you know, the fangs, you know, the whole thing. The human is a soft skin thing with crappy little weak fingernails and tiny little teeth, and you know, they're munching some vegetable and they'll eat a piece of meat if they find it somewhere running after they jump down out of the tree. But the omnivores, but they're feeble people, and they need to interact with each other, and their power comes from their interaction. And the militarist societies that pretend they're a bunch of mighty hunters is a bunch of BS. They were hiding in a cave with that tiger growling outside. Mark, what should we do? And then Nina or Arlene said, "Hey guys, here's a little stick I use for cooking. Make a big one and go out there and say, cut up to that tiger." "Oh, thanks, dear." "You go first. You first. I'll follow you." That's the mighty hunter. But then we figure out all these horrible things and we can nuke the whole universe. With hatred.
I hope you can hear me.
Yes. Sorry?
If we're all stuck here together and our intention...
We're all stuck here together?
Yeah, and our intention is to... love and be kind to each other, right? Make the best of it.
Yeah.
How do you suggest we do that in the current political environment where there's so much hate and anger? Like, how do you love the people who hate?
Well, how can we, the politics and the whole thing have to be fulfilled with hate, you think?
Yeah.
Well, if you watch them on TV, you realize it's very hard for them. They're having a really hard time. They're like, they put on all kind of weird totems. You know, and the animal-looking hats, and try to look like predator, and they have guns, and they're all sweating, and they're behaving like they wouldn't behave with grandma. And they're like trying to pump themselves up to go out and be mean and do crazy things, because they have, you know, Wilhelm Reich called it, they have the emotional plague. They've been conditioned not to feel anything, and so therefore they feel very bereft and isolated and psychotic. And so they somehow, the only way they can contact is go and do some violence. And then they harm someone and they wriggle and then they feel a pulse of life or something. So they become sadistic and so on. But they're struggling to do it. Look at the Nazi in chief, Goldilocks there. Look at him. You think he looks cheery? What? Where's the general? Bannon? Oh, he's giving a hug to that like collapsed looking character like Bannon? It's hard for them to be nasty. Human beings make a big effort. They go to military training and they do all this stuff. They have the emotional plague. Read Wilhelm Reich. They can't feel. They're upset. They're struggling to be vicious. They're not naturally vicious. That's the whole point. And how come it's so? Well, I think it's a great sign, actually, that we're seeing it all out. And now it's all, in the old days, like 200 years ago, some czar and some king and some aristocrat or something with their private slaves and armies and serfs and peasants whipping them on, and a whole hierarchy of people, one people whipping another, you know, the whole authoritarian cascade. And they'd be driving out the cannon fodder out there to slaughter each other while they sat back feeling like actually subconsciously deeply distressed and frustrated and, you know, and all uptight, you know, totally uptight. You know, the kings, the French kings, do you know what they had to eat? Louis XIV? Instead of a nice duck confit with hot sauce and a plum and some like nice veggies around it, and swimming in a good sauce, you know, all steaming hot, slurping it down carnivorously. Instead of that, they had duck meat, all like 40 ducks, all pasted together with lard in a giant swan with a palace and a castle and lard white trees and the meat. And it would be brought out in a big platter with sculpture. And then they would have to eat this cold, greasy, weird food. And then they had gout and they'd have to wash it down with this. And then people were pissing in the street and crapping there and throwing it in the street in a little loose in the middle of the street so they got some perfume. They were having a miserable time. And the English, why did they conquer the world and waste all the people in Africa and India? Because they had Yorkshire pudding was like shoe leather with some boiled, overboiled, horrible like elk meat, like, yeah, let me out of this island. And go find some mangoes and cook some spicy thing with some curry. It's misery. So how come it's so awful? But you see, they would all do that in hiding in their palace. And we'd be down there at some level of the slave hierarchy, terrified for our lives and abusing somebody else underneath us. And then the occasional weirdo who wanted to meditate and said, I'm God, after all, felt inside, oh, that's Satan in there. We'd get burned at the stake. Down the hierarchy, they burn that person at the stake. The lady, the old lady out in the suburb who knew how to cure the common cold with some herb, she gets burned at the stake as a witch. But hundreds of thousands of them, they're so freaked out. But now, and no one would really see it, you see, so they would carry on with it. But now we see them on television. You know, justice, law and order, we're going to lock everybody up. I liked them Ku Klux Klan boys until I heard they smoke pot. What? We see this complete caricature of human beings. So we won't tolerate it for that long. They can keep brainwashing us, and Breitbart can get a few crazed people to watch Breitbart rather than watching Doctor Who or the Starship Enterprise. That's a liberal conspiracy, that Starship Enterprise. Those guys with the weird ears, that's the wrong race. We're going to shoot them. Vulcan, we will shoot them. We sold them Vulcan. We need to get them. Come on, you know. Maybe Obama was a Vulcan. So, but now they're out in the open. And they're all there. Everyone can see them. And so they're none of them, from China to the U.S. or anywhere, they're not doing the will of the people. They are not spending the money on what the people want. The people don't want to kill their neighbors. They don't want a huge defense budget. They want day school. They want medicine. They want nice roads. They want infrastructure. They want solar panels. They don't want these idiots. And now we can see them all the time on the TV. So how dense do we have to be before more than 50% of us vote? And before white women don't vote for Hillary because they don't like her cheeks. Because she looked like a chipmunk who swallowed one acorn too many. And all those white women didn't vote for her. What's the matter with them? They voted for that creep to come and grab their ass. But he only does that because he can't get any satisfaction out of any one of them. Because he's all locked up in his dominator mode. Poor guy. Poor guy. You have to feel sorry for the guy. But because we can't afford to, because he's not jumping on us. Look at his wife. She's like, what, they dance together? Did you see that? I shouldn't digress in such things.
You're answering the question.
Is this okay? Is that an answer? So take heart. The key thing is, don't get mad. Stay humorous. You see the thing, but resist happily, joyfully, resist with humor, resist by voting. If 75% in Sweden, 95% of people vote, and they have basically better governments. Occasionally they get over-immigrated and they get a little bit of a right-winger, but mainly they have good governments, and the women are powerful there, you know, in Sweden. I have one. didn't come today. So the point is, it's a good sign that the old military industrial type rulers are visible to us, and they're totally incompetent, and we're lucky they haven't, they're bombing, but the sad people in Iraq and Syria and everywhere where they've been actually killing people and dropping unnecessary bombs and doing things, that's really, really sad, and that's creating bad karma for us, because we didn't vote them out. We didn't resist them enough. We kind of didn't bother. Because we thought, we were brainwashed that it doesn't matter what we do. We're brainwashed that we don't have power. Every single person here has power. And we could vote. If we had 80% vote here, then Jeff Sessions, he'd be in therapy. He would. He would not be trying to refill more prisons with more slaves to reinstate Jim Crow and slavery. He wouldn't be doing that. He wouldn't be able. He'd be totally voted out. Dalai Lama's advice, I was not agreeing with him in the last interview I did with him for Rolling Stone. He said about ISIS, the thing to do is to talk to them, the ISIS people. And I said, what do you mean you can't talk to them? They'll shoot you before you can talk to them. He said, oh, you can arrange that. Just, you know, some of them you can find without guns and then talk to them. So that's true, of course, that's true. The only way to overcome terrorism is not counter-terrorism. That'll never end. The only way to do it is to not be terrified and to try to deal with them. And that in Buddhist mythology, that's always the way they deal with the evil and the demons. They have a lot of stories like that. Buddha never destroys any demons. You know, these fierce deities you see back here, come from India, and although this is a Tibetan painting, but they do like that. What they do is they immobilize the demon. They sit him down, right? And in the case of really fierce ones, they have to be kind of chained down for a while. And then they talk to them. And then endless, interminable weekend retreats. And like, you know, and massages and relax and like deal with the Reiki and inner armory that may make them unable to feel their own inner streaming, which is why they are so violent and freaked out, because they're trying to break out of the prison of their own messed up neurology and coming down inherited, you know. And sure, you're absolutely right. That's Dalai Lama's advice. That's the ultimate thing, is to try to do that. And one by one, we can do that. But unfortunately, you know, sometimes they will kill us on our way to tea time conversation. They'll shoot us. And their point is, don't die with hatred for them. You know, die happily. And then we'll be reborn, we'll get them another life, another person will come. There's no way we won't get to Shangri-La. Shambhala, it's called Shambhala. We'll get there. We're getting there. This is Shakyamuni's planet. So it's all going to be fine, because it is fine. Even those guys are fine. But they're just not having any fun. That's why they're out there trying to beat somebody up, or even just kill themselves. Because they just can't stand being in the cage of the way they've been wrongly conditioned. No, and miseducated. So we can't hate them. Worst. David Duke was my mother in a previous life. The horrible thing is he'll be my mother again if I don't help him out in this life. But sometimes you have to restrain them, on the other hand, because then they won't listen and they'll shoot you before you can.
Episode of the Bob Thurman Podcast was originally broadcast during the Addiction, Depression, and Recovery Retreat with Mark Epstein and Bob Thurman, held at Menla Mountain Retreat, summer 2017. To learn about this intensive program held annually at Menla in Phoenicia, New York, please visit menla.us. Also learn about upcoming events with Mark Epstein, Sharon Salzberg, and Bob Thurman together at Tibet House in May. Visit tibethouse.us. To watch the full video recordings from this program and other past programs held at Menla and at Tibet House, please visit the Tibet House US member archives or the Tibet House US YouTube channel. And now back to Mark and Bob with the second half of this week's podcast.
I have a question to either yes? one of you. I have a better understanding now of what emptiness means, but I'm curious if you could perhaps maybe expound on the correlation, if there is one, between emptiness and the 12-step notion of powerlessness. I'm just curious if there's a relationship between the two and what your perspective might be on that.
Could you hear?
Which I think I can answer.
He said he has a better understanding of emptiness now, but he's wondering if one of us could talk about how the idea of emptiness relates to the AA notion of powerlessness.
Of powerlessness,
like I'm powerless over alcohol or I'm powerless over my addictions, basically.
The theistic version in the 12 step is that you, when you recognize your powerlessness, although they don't use the language of emptiness, but when you recognize your powerlessness, it's you seek a higher power, you surrender your own notion of power coming out of your own intrinsic identity self. It obviously can't work. And then you allow a higher power to come through you, right? That's that whole thing they do with AA. But in the Buddhist version, it's love that comes through you. In other words, you're empty of this ego-centered power, because you emptiness lets you give in, surrender to the interrelatedness of reality, and that your higher power comes from the need of all the others, the other beings, not from some God, but from the other beings. You follow me? They all need something, and that's in my patented formula for why the good guys can always beat the bad guys. Is because the bad guys are only operating for themselves. They just want, they are working for number one, basically. They're isolated from others, so they're just working for themselves. There's lots of bad guys. The good guys are working for everybody. So they're, even the bad guy, they want to help out the bad guy. So they have a much greater source of power. But it's not that narrow, ego-centered type of power. It's the power of love, of wanting to fulfill the need and the wish of the many others. It's a much greater power. But it can only come through the emptiness surrender of my old, feeble definition of like me, I'm the one, you know. As my old Mongolfin used to say, decades before Neo was wondering who was he the one in the Matrix, he said, everybody goes around secretly thinking to themselves, I'm the one. He said that. So naturally, when I saw The Matrix, I was freaking out. Remember the article, are you the one, Sonny? Have a cookie? You know, oh, she told me I wasn't the one. It's really brilliant. The Wachowskis are, I heard the Wachowskis are from Marley Bremen. So great. So I think that's the thing. So since the psychoanalysis is not, although if one of your patients is theistic in their own worldview, and they find that somehow God or Yahweh or something mm-hmm. comes through them that helps them, I'm sure you acknowledge that work.
Jesus.
And if
Jesus
they're not,
okay with
then
me.
It's the relationships with the other people, which is more the Buddhist thing.
Right.
Right? That it's the source. So then you give up your own self-power idea to some extent, and then you let the need of the others through love, because of your love of them, empowers you more greatly. That's that idea. Okay? That's a good question.
Yeah. So that's from a place not of weakness, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's from a place not of weakness, more of strength then, right? When this powerlessness.
Yeah, well, you know, in a way, it's realistic. That's the wonderful thing, you know, like Dark Night of the Soul, you know, that sort of thing, you know, San Juan de la Cruz. Before you feel the union with the divine, Teresa de Avila, Juan de la Cruz, you have to go through the Dark Night of the Soul. Dark Night of the Soul for them means where you kind of give up. You realize you yourself, you can't manage. And in the whole thing about emptiness, that kind of, when people say, I realize emptiness, in a way, that was their last defense against realizing emptiness. Because when you realize emptiness, the realizer is just as empty as the thing realized. So it has you, you don't have it. And what it is an infinite field of relations, relationality. Because emptiness is also empty. There's the emptiness of emptiness. Because the one way emptiness is not a bomb is if you make it into the absolute. And you think, and then you let that runaway thing, you know, to go off into the psychotic world of you all alone in the universe. Because nobody else is there to bug you, because they don't exist. And in the holistic misunderstanding of emptiness. So you do find that you surrender. You let yourself go down to you do surrender. So you do embrace weakness. And then what's lucky is you discover through that surrender of the little ego power is this vast infinite power of all beings. You know? Mm-hmm. And actually in that light, the female is more advanced than the male among the human different embodiments. I hate to say this, but it's really true. And that's why a female is more empathetic and more naturally tends toward empathy and so forth, you know, and they actually bear the other being. They, you know, their belly becomes a condo without having been able to examine the occupant. They don't know where it came from. Total stranger. Oh, no, are you the rebirth of David Duke? Oh, no. And they don't even ask that question. And the male, which male? Don't even step on my toe. I mean, what? I'm going to give up my calcium, my space in my stomach? Give me a break. So there, that weakness is lead to the greater strength. It's like martial arts, Aikido. You know, you just move out of the way, and their own violence tangles them up, and they collapse. My wife met the national treasurer of Japan, who was the founder of Aikido. Mm-hmm. Jim met him, actually. I wasn't there. jealous me. And he was asked by the professor that she was with, like, what was his secret after he had demonstrated a whole bunch of big guys jumped on him, and they all ended up falling down around him, and he was a little guy. And then he said, the secret is, well, I have no secret. He said, they're all like my brothers. He said, all beings are my brothers and sisters. He said, everybody's my brother and sister. So I just don't get in their way. And, you know, I want them to get what they want. The professor was very frustrated. It didn't sound like it. He had a gimmick. You know, like, everybody's my brother and sister, the little guy said. So that's the infinite strength of ego weakness. In a way, it's resilience of the ego. In other words, it's able to, you know, that's a strong ego, it's a resilient one. I think, say, Winnicott, these guys, they know that. Maybe Freud thought maybe we had to have a stronger...
I don't think he really thought so. No, okay. He called the ego a necessary... Huh? He called it a necessary fiction.
Right, the one difference, though, the only difference is that there's no infinite unconscious. The task of the human life is to become fully conscious of absolutely everything. Everything about one's own neuroscience, even how, where, which neuron is hopping where. That's the clear height of the void now. So the unenlightened has a huge unconscious. Tip of the iceberg thing works. The Daniel Kahneman type thing, oh, we're all helpless. But Buddhist psychology is not like that. That's where you start, but then you because of samadhi power and Vipassana power, you get to understand your own unconscious completely. That's the task. Why? Because, like in a dream, right, your unconscious produces things that surprise you and drive you in place. You have nightmares or pleasure things that you didn't expect. So after death, it's like a dream thing. And if you're being driven by unconscious impulse, you don't know where you're going to go. So people who are afraid of their own unconscious are the ones who are really afraid of death. Because they all sense subliminally that there is going to be continuity, because that's where everything in nature is continuity. There's no non-continuity in nature. If you define anger as a kind of heat energy that gives you a kind of forcefulness, but you're in charge of it. You can either do or not do, you can express it. Then that can be useful. It's very tricky to manage because it wants to take over. Because what happens, Sanjideva has the beautiful analysis. What happens is, the things that make you angry are a buildup of frustration. Frustration comes from something that you think is not correct, that is happening, is not being prevented, and you get frustrated. Or something that should be happening is being blocked, and you get frustrated. Then the frustration builds, and then anger comes to you in the form of your own voice. Like, what is this crap? I'm going to put a stop to that. And it says, you're feeling too weak to do anything about it, but once you line up with me, you're going to be a powerhouse. But that's a trick. That's what an addict gets. You drink a bottle of vodka, then you'll get them. You take the cocaine, then you'll do it. It tells you that, and then actually you have adrenal responses and everything, and you collapse. And also when you're very clumsy how you behave. And they have studies, you know, when you really lose your temper, your 85% of your judgment disappears. And you misjudge the situation and you do the wrong thing. And it makes it worse almost usually. So where anger, you know, in the ancient Western moralists and in the Buddhist ones, you know, anger is the one that is defined as that which takes you over. Where you are just, your body and mind are the tool of this forceful heat that then just drags you, and you just flail there. You know, you break things you value, you hurt people you love, you destroy, you kill yourself even. People will, they're angry enough, that kind of anger. That is always no good. And that is all, that's like an addiction. It seems to make you strong, but actually destroys you. Okay? Now, if you understand that, and you don't let yourself be carried away like that, and then you based on the seeing the situation, there's two things that he says. The most important thing is maintain good cheer, which means when you see it starting to go wrong, you intervene forcefully before you've lost it. And you're forceful while still humorous, while still out of cheerfulness and joyfulness. And then you are much more effective, okay? And you get a little strength and heat like that. That's the first thing. I call that creative rudeness, you know? The idiot is about to tell you a bunch of nonsense and vote for Trump, et cetera, or whatever, and or be like, let's bomb Korea, or whatever. Some idiot is about to do that. And you know that they're going there in the first sentence, but you're a woman in America, so you've been socialized to be polite and listen. And then by the end of the paragraph of the moron, you're really pissed off and you'll say some rude, really bad thing. So instead, you interrupt while you're still, you make a joke. Oh, yeah, oh, great, Dr. Strangelove, sure, you're going to ride those missiles down into Pyongyang, are you? Or something like that. And then they're like, oh, you interrupted me, they get all woofed out. But actually, they feel that you're still cool, so they can't get that freaked out. They might march off, but then you're spared having to list the rest of the paragraph. You're spared the frustration buildup. So that's one of the things. And then finally, sometimes you really can't do anything about it. He has this great verse. He says, why get furious about something if you can do something about it? Just do it. And if you can't do anything about it, why get furious about it on top of that? Then that just eats at you. Actually, in some cases, you can't do anything. Whatever it is, you remain cheerful. You know? Why did the British conquer the planet as opposed to the French? Because the British stopped for a spot of tea and the Cheerio. And the French are waiting for the evening wine and they get more like romantic and pissed off. So the British won that one. Both are barbarians, but the British won out that time. Okay? Because of cheerfulness. You're much stronger when you're cheerful. And so it depends on how you define the anger.
Talking about anxiety and depression and even addiction, it doesn't always exist solely in one generation, in one individual in one generation, uh-huh. That it actually stretches back
Okay.
Several generations.
Yeah, could be.
And that can be that can feel like an overwhelming pressure or an overwhelming responsibility. Is there anything in Buddhism to help with either healing backwards, I think is the implication, or else it not being overburdened by that load that one might be carrying. Is that fair?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you want me to try that?
I think maybe we should both try it.
Okay, you go first.
I think the first answer is like what they tell doctors when they're being trained, you know, like when someone's having a heart attack, they say take your own pulse first. So you before you can do anything for anybody else, you have to be in a reasonable state of mind yourself. So if the generations have tumbled down to you and you're holding all of the distress, the first thing you actually can do is do something about yourself. So even if your already developed compassionate impulse is to try to save your mother or your grandmother or your father or his father or whatever, the impulse is generous, but the wiser course of action is to first stabilize yourself.
Yeah.
And there can be a kind of fantasy of being able to go backwards and make everything better for people who have already suffered and are already well into their lives. There can even be a fantasy of going backwards into one's own childhood and reclaiming the affection or the attention or the acknowledgement that one never had. And I see a lot of people still battling it out with their 80-year-old parents, you know, trying to get them to see them as a real person, which they never did. And one of the things that I sometimes read that I brought along talks about that impulse being the most violent kind of nostalgia that we have, because there's still so much anger wrapped up in trying to make it right. So that doesn't mean that there isn't stuff to do for people who have, like in Sharon's story, for her father in living out his life in a mental hospital and so on. It was important for her to go back and help him get set up in a living situation that he could tolerate, but she could never make him, you know, fully functional or fully better. So similarly with a loved one who is alcoholic or has a drug addiction, you know, the first thing you learn when you go to Al-Anon is that it's, you know, you can't stop that for anybody. You have to take care of yourself, and in taking care of yourself, sometimes you inspire that person that you care about. I think that's how I would try to talk about it.
That's wonderful. I completely agree with that. I think, but I might add to that, is the beauty of Buddha the scientist, Buddha the Darwin, with his beautiful theory of karma, which is a biological theory. It is not a mystical woo-woo thing. It's a biological theory. And the thing about the biological theory is that different people are born in some lineages, but that doesn't mean that they were in that lineage in a previous life. In other words, different people have been born in every different kind of lineage. So there's one more gene to be considered. There's the mother's and father's genes, you know, which ultimately people blame. So people blame the parents, because they only have the one life, so then their childhood, and then there's some kind of psychoanalysis tends to blame the parents. And then there's the other things about blame the genes, and then feel that somehow one is the heir of one's tribe, and they were suffered, and they were abused, and so forth, and one has to somehow deal with that. Or they were alcoholics, or whatever it was. But actually, we might not have been of the same lineage in the previous life. We might have been a McCoy, and now we're born as a Hatfield, and vice versa, in this biological lineage, in the Buddha's biological theory. There's no guarantee. And in fact, you might have taken rebirth in America. The blacks have been badly enslaved and tortured and treated horribly for a long period of time. And so maybe a lot of people your age are bodhisattvas who decided they would be reborn in that lineage to try to like help lift them up and make them equal and make them carry around those signs, you know. Those lives matter to these lunatics who want to continue with this nonsense. And similarly, some of those like white people might be people who were abused before and now they want to abuse somebody and they're reborn. So in other words, it mixes the nations and the tribes. It makes it harder, that biological theory makes it harder, and why Asia therefore was more gentle actually as a whole and therefore was conquerable by the Europeans, racist Europeans, because the Asian people had plenty of wars and stuff themselves, but over many, many hundreds of generations they had been having this biological theory was operative, where if you're Chinese now, you might have been a Tibetan in a previous life. You might have been an Indian, a life before that. Within India, there's hundreds of nations. You might have been a Bengali or a Punjabi or whatever it is. There's hundreds of them. It's not one country. And then you're reborn in the other one. And in fact, one of the strategies of people who get killed in these tribal wars is to be reborn in the one that won and then to get revenge that way. You know, it's a natural thing if they're lucky enough to be reborn as a human at all, actually, in fact, depending on how aware of themselves they were and how open-hearted they are. So that's a really nice thing when people say, oh, you got to take care of your great-grandfather's like suffering. You are willing to try, but you don't have to. The amazing thing about the human being is totally deprogrammable and totally reprogrammable. And therefore, the human being who becomes aware of that is responsible to program themselves in an optimal way. And they can make immense evolutionary progress in any one life. They can. And they don't have to, like, follow. That's the whole thing about humans. They're totally weird, you know. That's why education, you know, like oppressive societies have a big brainwashing thing they want to do. Because they know that the human being can be conditioned to be resisting them, to be wide open, not to follow their traditional thing, to rebel against it. The human being is very individualistic compared to other animals. The human being is not hardwired. That's totally fake. Oh, we're all hardwired for survival. Well, then how come in World War I, they had those people out there marching up into machine gun nests? And I don't know if you know that, but the first seven lines of the marchers in World War I were only meant to absorb bullets. That was their job. And there was a guy behind them who was going to shoot them if they turned back, and their own tribe. And then the eighth one was able to jump into the trenches and struggle with the guys who ran out of bullets. And how come people were able to be persuaded to do that? If human beings are programmed for survival. So we all know they can be totally reprogrammed on hatred, on pseudo-speciation, the Germans, or from the German side, the British, or the French, whoever it is, are subhuman, so they're just, they're horrible, we have to kill all of them. Whatever it is, it's all been going on for thousands of years amongst tribes. And any one person has the capability of completely changing that at any time. But they need to hear that it's possible. They have to have help to do it and so forth. And they have to have education. It's key. Education, therefore, is everything for the human being. And it's not just, you know, they always go in Buddhist translations, the three trainings. Everything is a training. Everybody translates, oh, training. I'm going to go get trained. No way. That's dogs and cats and people get trained. Toilet training. Those words, shiksha, adishiksha, means higher education. Shiksha means to learn. It means education. And we don't believe that. All your Buddhists, they don't want to hear about that. I have a PhD and I'm still miserable. And I'm still an idiot. So what could education do for me? Well, it was the wrong education, how about? It wasn't an education of your heart. It wasn't an education of your sensitivity, of your humanness. No. Yeah, there was a little humanities in there. The worst paid and the least important for the pre-meds and the pre-laws and the pre-Wall Street and the pre-militarists is a little humanities, and they go and read Dickens, you know. Or Tolstoy or something before getting out there and becoming master of the universe. So my point is, don't over-worry about it, you know, and don't accept. You know, I had an epiphany at Amherst College, where I taught, which is supposed to be the cream of the, it actually is better undergraduate education within the Western American education than the big research universities where the great professors send their graduate students to teach the undergrad too much. And there was this one, the three Buddhas that everyone had to study. Darwin, Marx, and Freud. Those are the three Buddhas of liberal education. Okay? But what's the upshot of Darwin, Marx, and Freud? Darwin, your genes are driving you and you're this helpless carrier of genes. Marx, your social position determines everything you think and say and you just can't get out of that. And you're going to think according to where you're located in society. You know? You're brainwashed, right? And Freud, your unconscious is driving you and it ends up like Kahneman. I'm so happy I read a little thing in the London Review of Books about Kahneman.
Mm-hmm.
Those guys did their initial studies for the Israeli military.
Mm-hmm.
They're all military. And Tavis and Kahneman, this whole thing about the new discovery that we're so helpless and we're just nudged by our unconscious to do everything we think we made, but reason is useless, so don't resist. You resistance is futile, you will become integrated in the Borg and you will fight your enemies forever. That's a bunch of BS. So your liberal arts great humanities student is told by science, Darwin, Marx, and Freud, social science, psychology, and biology, that they're helpless. There's nothing they can really do with themselves. So then, get out, go to Wall Street and make some money. Oh, what the hell? And when you die, you'll be nothing if you've done the bad stuff. So who cares? You're nothing. So have some fun. Make some money. That's ridiculous. A human being has complete power to determine fate, and not only that, responsibility to do so. And every manipulator and dominator of every society knows that, and that's why they have myths and legends and fanatical beliefs that they enforce, and inquisitions of people who don't believe in it, and they torture them and fry them and do things, because the human being is completely capable of completely changing themselves. And actually, your good one can become a mass killer, and your bad one can become a saint. Human beings completely flexible. And therefore, anyone who begins to get a glimpse of that is responsible for educating themselves toward the good. Because that's the purpose of human life. That's why we came into this weird thing and we didn't reborn as a lion. Then we get out and we eat some wildebeest. We don't have to go to McDonald's. They just run by, all fresh. We jump on them. Actually, we have Mrs. Lion do it for us. if we're a male lion, we're too lazy to hunt. So that's the Buddhist view anyway. That's the Buddhist biology view. And there's one thing about all biology views and all scientific views, actually. All descriptions in Buddhist science, all descriptions of relative reality are only relative. They're not absolute dogma. There is no such grand unified theory where the intellectual scientific ego is going to find some way to control everything. That's why Einstein freaked out when the Niels Bohr and Heisenberg and those guys said, you get down to a certain level and there's no more objectivity. Your mind is engaged with it, you interfere with what you observe, observer and observed is all interwoven, and so there's no, you can't catch it. But we can do a lot of stuff on the surface with the probabilities, and we can maneuver and we can improve things, ameliorate things, we can do a lot of great stuff. But we can't catch it with an ultimate theory. And then remember Einstein said God does not play dice, he rebelled against it, and then we have all this weird stuff like 11 dimensions and strings, blink, 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 and all this kind of thing. And they're all pretending they're going to find some way of controlling. The central supercomputer is going to like know everything from the subatomic Higgs boson up. A bunch of nonsense. They're going to have to learn to surf the energy with their own mind. When their mind and the subjectivity is mingled with the objectivity, then that's another way of always accounting for the subjectivity and the bias, and really knowing by merging in an inexpressible way. That's where it's going to go. When the inner science complements and actually helps out the material science. So even that biological theory, although it has this great side effect, It's, you know, as a relative theory, it's therefore, in a way, probably the most sophisticated biological theory that it is, there is. And nowadays, certain philosophers of biology are calling for that. They're calling for bringing the mind back into the way life is formed as a kind of another element without going back to theism, you know, and some kind of sort of just absolute control by some outside absolute. And this Thomas Nagel, Mind and Cosmos, I recommend that you read, that you'll find out. And that's what karma theory already is. Mind shapes the form of life, along with genes of parents. So there's three genes. And therefore, you don't have to get carried away that you have to do redeem. You have to redeem everybody's forefathers. We have to redeem all of the crimes and the things forever. But we're not saddled with it in this way, you know. Because we've won this marvelous life form. Each one of you is like a miracle. Human being. Unbelievable creature. Remember Carl Sagan in Cosmos? He would walk down the cosmic map and he would go billions and billions. He was just doing genes, but he would show what a miracle, like even the shoulder joint is, the elbow, you know, the fingers. You know. It's incredible, human being, and the brain is unbelievable. And there's a lot more stuff inside, the heart, the navel, amazing. And so that's we read this sort of thing, and it's actually better than we can been and we have been divine. We can become divine, but that's not the point. Buddha is not specifically divine. He said to be teacher of humans and gods. In Theravada they even have that expression: Deva Manushyanam Shastra in Sanskrit, and it's similar. In they just drop some of the consonant clusters in Pali, but same. So the human one is the one that is still vulnerable and still alive, but has a divine type of intelligence and can kind of figure out what it means and what it's for, and then can be a huge benefactor of other beings, the greatest possible benefactor of other beings. And that's the beginning of the path. The reason we waste so much time in our lives and worry about so many things is we don't take ourselves seriously enough. We don't really know what precious equipment we have as humans. And we assume we'll always be, or we'll be nothing later, so who cares? You know, this moment that we have as a human being, however many any of us have left, you know, it's of infinite value, to not just to us, to everyone. We can be so great and helpful to so many. And we can be harmful too to ourselves, but we have this amazing platform that we have, a human platform.
Weekly interstitial music provided by Tenzing Chogyal. Used with the artist's permission, all rights reserved. To learn more about Tenzing Chogyal, please visit his website at tenzingchogyal.com. Bob Thurman Podcast is brought to you in part through the generous support of the Tibet House U.S. membership community and listeners like you. To learn more about the benefits of Tibet House membership, please visit tibethouse.us. Study Buddhism up close and personal with Robert Thurman during one of his intensive programs at Menlo Retreat in Phoenicia, New York, or during one of the Tibet House U.S. member trips with Geographic Expeditions in 2018. Trips this year include Mongolia and Bhutan. To learn more about these member trips, please visit bobthurman.com. Thanks for tuning in, and Tashi Dilek.